You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the afternoon to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. The Department of Justice and the FBI have both opened investigations into the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin down in Florida. The state of Florida just announced about an hour ago, in addition to this, that they're going to impanel a grand jury. Why? Because this thing has gone national. Joe Madison, for example, the talk show host here in Washington, D.C., brilliant guy, a good friend, very, very, very insightful fellow. He has enhanced the 9/11 tape where the George Zimmerman, the guy who killed Martin, was chasing Martin and talking to the police on this 911 call, and the police are saying, don't chase him. Trayvon Martin, by the way, the crime he committed, he was visiting a relative in this neighborhood, and he walked to the 7-Eleven and bought a can of iced tea and a bag of Skittles. He had a can of iced tea in his hand and a bag of Skittles in the other hand, and this is what George Zimmerman thought was a weapon, and thought that he was suspicious in the neighborhood because he was a black guy in the neighborhood. Martin was shot and killed last month by a neighborhood watch volunteer. This is George Zimmerman. And because of the shoot first laws in Florida, which were approved by the American Legislative Exchange Council in 2005 for distribution to the states, and we now have in 16 states. Originally, these laws were written by the NRA. George Zimmerman claims, oh, he was just acting in self-defense. Because now, if you shoot somebody out in public, all you have to do is say, I felt threatened. You don't have to prove that you were threatened, which is what happened under the old law. Under the old law, you had to at least prove that you were under threat. Now all you have to do is basically say it. Oh, I felt like I was threatened. Now, this guy was actually, Zimmerman actually was chasing Trayvon Martin. Here's a grown adult chasing a 16-year-old kid who weighs 50 pounds less than him, who is armed with a bag of Skittles, and the adult is armed with a semi-automatic pistol. And Zimmerman, and by the way, Zimmerman had made over 40 phone calls to 9/11 in the preceding months since he'd become a neighborhood watch guy. About, oh, this garage door is open. Oh, there's a suspicious person looking in the neighborhood. You know, suspicious usually being African-American. New 9/11 tapes and eyewitness accounts paint a very different picture. One in which Zimmerman murdered Martin in cold blood on the street. Here's a clip from that.
He's running. He's running. Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay. Which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Yeah, now it was very faint on there, faint enough that I think that we could legally play it because it's pretty hard to hear. But as I said, Joe Madison on his show had enhanced this tape to the point where you could hear Zimmerman under his breath saying effing coon as he's chasing this young man. And not effing, but spelling, you know, saying the word. Zimmerman has yet to be tried for any crime. He hasn't been arrested. He's protected by Florida's, the guys who love these laws call them the stand your ground law. You're out in public. Somebody walks up to you, you don't like what they're doing, you can pull out a gun and shoot them, right? Stand your ground. The people who are opposed to these laws call them shoot first laws. They allow Floridians to use deadly force against perceived threats. Former homicide detective Rod Wheeler said on Monday, reacting to this case, that the stand your ground law, or the shoot first law, now makes it illegal to shoot and kill dogs. But if you shoot and kill a black kid in Florida, quote, you can walk away, end quote. Now, how do we get these things? It was a spasm of national paranoia, promoted by ALEC since the summer of 2005, the Koch Brothers American Legislative Exchange Council, but originated with the National Rifle Association, apparently, everything we've been able to find. searching on the interwebs. 16 now states have now adopted these shoot-first laws, like the one Florida adopted in 2005. It used to be that if you killed somebody, you had to demonstrate that you had a reasonable fear that they were going to harm you. Now, you don't have to prove that. You can merely assert it. Police and prosecutors across the country have condemned these laws, but they've been ignored by people frightened by watching too many crime TV shows and listening to politicians who pander to fear, basically. You know, right now, we're actually safer than we've been at any time since the end of the Reagan administration. Murder rates started to spike when Ronald Reagan came into office as the economy crashed. And they actually reached a peak in 91, about 3 years after Reagan left office, before Bill Clinton was able to turn it around with, you know, by raising taxes. The reality is that America's murder rates are right now lower than at any time in the last half century. Almost half of the peak reached around the end of the Reagan administration. Half. We're safer now than we've ever been. But fear still sells. And fear, combined with these shoot-first laws, allows people like George Zimmerman, with his history of calling 9/11 over 40 times out of various fears, and his semi-automatic pistol, to kill people like Trayvon Martin. And frankly, the state of Florida has put together a grand jury to look into this case, but I don't believe that they would have if it hadn't gotten this kind of national publicity. How many more kids, particularly how many more minority kids, are going to be murdered by frightened white guys with guns who read too many NRA publications and are watching too much Fox News that would have you believe that this is the most horrible time in the history of America? No, sorry. It's safer now than it was during Reagan. In fact, the murder rate started going up during the Reagan administration. And then it peaked out when Bill Clinton raised taxes on rich people and balanced the budget and started putting things back together in 92. How many more kids will be murdered by frightened white guys before these laws that give killers immunity are dismantled? This blows my mind. You know, it used to be that you could shoot somebody coming into your home if you had reasonable, if you had a reason to believe that they were going to harm you or they were not going to run out the door when you confronted them. Now you can simply shoot them because they're in your home under these laws. It used to be that out in public, you couldn't kill somebody unless you thought that they were going to kill you. Now all you have to do is say that you feel frightened or threatened in 16 states. Alaska's debating this. The Mudflats blog. Is this tourism campaign in our future? Writes Linda Kellen Bigel. She says, I've been waiting to see what crappy legislation would show up in this session. Ding, 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 we have our winner, House Bill 80. It's another bill that's come out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, where big-money companies, corporations, and special interests like the National Rifle Association have legislation drawn up to push their agenda. What this bill does, she writes, is remove any responsibility for someone to dial down a situation by leaving the area. And some members of the Alaskan law enforcement community aren't so thrilled. The prosecutor in Anchorage, James Fayette, he says, this is a bad idea. We'll do nothing to enhance the safety of law-abiding gun owners. What it will do is make it more difficult for me and my colleagues to convict violent criminals. But the National Rifle Association wants this passed. It'll help increase gun sales. And ALEC is perfectly willing to help them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's just amazing. I mean, you would think that the Koch brothers were only about, you know, gun, oil regulations. But, hey, the NRA is a dues-paying member, ALEC, too, apparently.
What would you do? What would you do? Do you know? I once had a grip on everything. It feels better to let go.
I will get to this as we go on through the day, but Paul Ryan also proposed today to cut taxes on millionaires, billionaires by $3 trillion and to pay for those tax cuts by cutting Social Security, Medicare, welfare programs, food stamp programs, basically, you know, Pell Grants for students, basically anything that helps the middle class or the poor. Paul Ryan wants to cut, and he wants to use those cuts to pay for a $3 trillion tax cut to millionaires and billionaires. We will get into that and the god-awful softball interview that Joe Scarborough committed this morning on this topic. Elton in Lima, Ohio. Hey, Elton, what's on your mind?
Tom, I'm calling regarding the Zimmerman case. I've heard of the 911 recording once, but there was this phrase in there that Zimmerman used that no one's repeated, and it was simply that he said something to the effect, they always get away with this, and then goes, not this time. And in my mind, that makes this first-degree murder, not manslaughter, that people are looking at. And I don't understand why nobody's grabbed hold of that.
Well, that's interesting. They always get away with this, not this. What, he's talking to himself, or he's talking to the dispatcher?
When he's on the phone with the dispatcher, right before he takes off chasing him, and I think right before she tells him, don't pursue, or,
right.
or exactly what the words were, but...
Yeah.
And okay. I haven't heard that on any other station since that one recording yesterday that when they played the entire tape. But
right.
that's frame of mind.
Yeah, it is. And that would establish first-degree murder. That's very interesting. Elton, thank you very much for the call. Jacob, let's play that short clip that we've got. I don't know that that's in this or not. It might be in the part that precedes it.
He's running. He's running. Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay. Which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Yeah, no, it's apparently earlier than that in the tape. Very interesting. Alfredo in Mountain View, California. Hey, Alfredo, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to point, it is horrendous what authorities are doing about this case, but I wanted to point out that the countries that do not allow guns have the lowest rates of crime of any other countries in the world. This gung-ho gun country that we have, which is primarily pushed by the special interests and the NRA is run by rednecks. And,
no, the NRA is run by businessmen. You can see them here in Washington D.C. The NRA is run by guys wearing $1,500 and $2,000 suits and
well,
Gucci
sure,
shoes.
Well, it's money. Sure, I agree with that. But yeah. Nevertheless, going back to the point that they are using this rhetoric that you need guns to defend yourself for
yeah.
crime. That's why we have police, and the countries that do not have. Guns again have the lowest rates in crime.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And I would say the NRA isn't run by rednecks, but they cater to the fears of Southern white
yeah.
men,
exactly.
You know, constantly. And
well put. Thank you. Don.
Yeah. All the more the tragedy. Thank you very much, Alfredo. Ah, here's the they always get away part from that clip, Jacob.
They always get away.
But he didn't. But there's no not this time right after it. No. Okay, Jacob's trying to track it down here. We're going through clips on the various internets. Stuart, St. Petersburg, Florida, says you disagree. What's up?
Oh, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think this guy should be prosecuted, and I think the sheriff should be investigated and probably lose his job. But what I am upset about with you, what you probably didn't say, or if you did say it, forgive me. But under the stand your ground in the state of Florida, you still can't be prosecuted. There was a case in Tampa. A man was prosecuted and found guilty.
Sure.
Other than that, this man here that shot this guy, let's say that he was Spanish descent, so I guess he was white-brown, you know, if you want to get to being as racial as I heard some of the callers on other programs saying this. It was not a white man.
Stuart, well, that's fine. I'll stand corrected if that's the case. But that still doesn't make this law right, that people can be prosecuted under this law. What this law basically says is that if you walk into a public area, you know, it used to be you walk into a public area and you feel threatened. You walk into the middle of a Hell's Angels crowd on the street, or you just walk up to, you know, somebody walks up to you who, in your opinion, is threatening. Your obligation was to de-escalate. In other words, to walk away. That's just, you know, common sense. Under this law, if you feel threatened, you can pull out a gun and shoot somebody. Now, tell me that makes sense.
It, it makes sense to some point, but then again, you have to justify
it. No, under the law that existed before this, and this is why all these prosecutors have come out against this law, Stuart, virtually unanimously, prosecutors and police chiefs are opposed to this law. Because under the old law, if somebody was threatening you, I mean, if somebody tries to carjack your car and they stick a gun in your face or it looks like they might or they've got any kind of weapon at all, you would be justified in using force against them, and even deadly force under appropriate circumstances. Under this law, you don't even have to demonstrate that they represent a threat to you. All you have to do is assert that you feel that there's a threat. And that seems to me like it's, you know, that's why they call these shoot first laws or license to kill laws. Because, you know, you've got a gun license and you've got a license to kill. And right. The NRA promoting these things, the American Legislative Exchange Council approving of them and distributing them as model legislation to the states, you know, ALEC, this Koch Brothers organization, it just blows my mind. I thought that they were only about, you know, making it so that they could their oil refineries could pollute more. You know,
but you have to understand that it goes back to where the police have to do their job under this stuff, and this sheriff did not do the job he was supposed to do. And
well, apparently the county thinks that because they're impaneling, I believe it's the county, might be a state grand jury. They're impaneling a grand jury, but as I said earlier, this would not have happened if the attention for this had not gone national. Stuart, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, in many ways, this Trayvon Martin case is similar to the invasion of Iraq. It's like, you know, make people afraid enough, and they will kill. Okay, I stand corrected. It's not perceived perception or anything like that. It's reasonable fear is the phrase in the law, which is equally vague and nasty. And Jacob, you have that clip. Are you done with that, or are you still working on it? I'll take a call for it. Oh, okay. This is we've had to bleep out a word, but apparently the killer did not say he's not going to get away with it this time, but he did say this.
Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. They always get away.
And he made sure that they didn't get away this time, apparently. DeCarlo in Oakland, California. Hey, DeCarlo, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm just calling to thank you. Good to hear. I was just wanting to comment on this shooting situation. Mm-hmm. And to me, and I know it may sound a little bit of a stretch to some of you, but you know, I really blame this on the situation that we have with the media and with, and forgive me, but the society's fascination with O.J. Simpson, because we continue, or the society continues to bring O.J. Simpson up as a cause of travesty of justice 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, when we have things like Timothy McVeigh, Charles Stewart, Susan Smith, where we know that crimes have been committed and they purposely put up other people in harm's way, and they rarely get mentioned again.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, DeCarlo, but I have not heard O.J. Simpson's name mentioned in any story, in any context, with regard to this crime.
No. But see, that's the point. I'm not saying in connection with it. I'm saying that this mentality, it's kind of like, you know, back in the olden days when, with the Nazis, how the Nazis, you know, once they started denigrating people of, you know, people of the Jewish faith,
right,
they didn't say that you're supposed to do something to them, but they insinuated,
right,
by denigrating them.
So what you're calling out here is cultural racism.
That's correct.
Right,
cultural,
right,
institutional
racism. And institutional, yeah, in the media as well. Okay, I got it. I don't disagree with you. In fact, I would add to that we have a media that makes a lot of money off of fear and a lot of money off scaring people. And I have never seen a news story that points out that the murder rate in the United States has been on a steady decline since the second or third year of the Bill Clinton administration. And right now,
no, I agree with you.
You know, I mean, it had hit a peak of around 700 per 100,000 or 700 per million or whatever it is 700. And it's now in the 400 range per whatever it is. And it's just, it's very, very low. And it's like nobody's saying, hey, we're safe. you know, everything's cool.
That was the same thing that they were pushing, though, back in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s, when Reagan was talking about how crime was going up and up and up. In reality, it was going down, but they had to have the perception of an increase of violence in the country to get the...
Well, actually, crime was going up during the Reagan administration, and I would submit to you that it was going up because he had destroyed the economy. And you know, a lot of people felt that that was the only option that they had, was, you know, to steal something, or whatever the crime may be. But the murder rate actually was going up throughout the Reagan administration, and it peaked in 92. So, it has radically dropped in the last year since then. DeCarlo, thanks a lot for the call.
Wait, one thing real quick.
Yeah, go for it.
Can I say this?
Yes, sir.
I'm just going to say, and the only reason I'm saying this also, again, with this O.J. situation, too, and with what you've mentioned, is I, you know, remember in L.A., Latasha Harlins was a 15-year-old girl who got shot in the back of the head on camera by a Korean market owner,
mm-hmm.
and it was over a bottle of orange juice. The woman got 5 months probation and then left the country.
Yeah.
This is on camera. So this is the kind of thing that's just been perpetuated within the society.
And yet, at the same time, if a how old was she?
15.
At the same time, if a 15-year-old white girl had gone missing, it would be a national, you know, cause celeb. And if she came back after a couple of years with her kidnapper, she would get her own talk show. I mean, it's like, I'm not
and
making this up.
A multi-billion dollar deal.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a, what you're identifying. I mean, I think you know, across the spectrum of Americans, there's a variety of opinions about O.J. Simpson. But setting that aside, what you're identifying is institutional racism and racism within the media. I don't think that there's any possibility of disputing that. And so anyway, DeCarlo, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Dwayne in Seattle. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's
up? I just wanted to be brief. You know, normally I would say, you know, a reasonable amount of fear. If you encountered a grizzly bear in the woods, and if you had a reasonable amount of fear, you'd go the opposite way.
Yeah, you would think.
Yeah.
But under this law, if you have reasonable fear, you can pull a gun and shoot.
You can pursue him. He said, are you chasing him? And he said, yes, I am. He said, well, we don't want you to do that.
Right.
And he kept on going after. And then you hear the child scream, help, help.
Right.
If he's being an aggressor,
right,
you know, he wouldn't holler at help, help.
And this is a kid who was armed with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea, which
right.
he had just bought at the 7-Eleven, and he was walking back to his relative's house that he was staying with. And
absolutely.
And this kid's crime, Dwayne, and let's just call it what it is. This kid's crime was walking in a white neighborhood while he was black.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, see, this is murder, and this has got to stop in America. I mean, you know, I have a young son, and you know how that affects me and my psyche.
Sure.
You know that this can happen. The sheriff has to go, and that prosecutor has to go.
Yep.
You know,
I'm with you.
So, I mean,
we
in America, we've got to be better than this. We've got to see it, like you said, Tom. It's racism, plain and simple.
It really is, and it's exposing that horrible core that, frankly, I was just astounded. I'm astounded to this day that most people don't know that the first speech that Ronald Reagan gave after he was appointed or elected at the Republican National Convention to be the candidate for president in 1980, on the official candidate for the Republican Party, the first speech he gave was a speech on states' rights, in which he said that the Supreme Court has misinterpreted the 10th Amendment and has misinterpreted states' rights, and we need to roll that back. And he gave, in other words, this is code for Brown versus Board of Education, and he said laws have been passed, they need to be rolled back, which was code for the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and he said. And he said this in Philadelphia, Mississippi, a town of 7,000 people in Mississippi that is only famous for the fact that three civil rights workers were murdered there, and it was made into the movie Mississippi Burning and other things. And that was Ronald Reagan's first official act as candidate for president of the United States. And at the time, those of us looking at it said, okay, he used to be in movies with chimps, and he used to be, he was an awful governor of California, you know, attacking kids and free education and everything else. And we called him Ronnie Reagan. And now he's openly racist America is going to reject this guy, and what did we do? We elected him. And that, to me, says that, you know, in 1980 it was still here, back in the 60s, when LBJ, you know, took a bullet for his party, as it were. You know, he said, I'm going to lose the Democratic Party to the South for a generation, and he did. And to this day, right now, this case, it has not changed. It has not changed. Well, I shouldn't say it has not changed. I see in my kids and their friends that there is a big difference in their attitude about racial relations, people who are under 30, let's say.
Well, you're absolutely right. I encourage the young people. They say they don't. I've seen a young guy was in a confrontation, and he said, "You know, I reject that racist thinking."
Yeah.
And let me say this last thing here.
Sure.
You know, when you spoke about Ronald Reagan being elected, my wife had said he's going to be elected president. And do you know? I laughed. I said, "No."
Me too. Me too. I'm saying, you know, there's no way that people are going to elect this guy. And in fact, Jimmy Carter had very, very high ratings right up until about a month and a half before the election. And that was only because the only reason Jimmy Carter lost that election was because Reagan's the head of his campaign, Bill Casey, had cut a deal with the Iranians to hold those hostages.
You know, it's unwritten, but yeah, that's what it was, you know.
Barbara Honecker wrote a book about it called October Surprise. Dwayne, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Bill in Valrico, Florida. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to tell you, there's a very similar case about an hour and a half from Sanford where a kid was murdered. About a year and a half ago, there was a black gentleman, retired school bus driver, who was yelling at a kid across the street from his house who was riding his skateboard on a basketball court. So this retired black school bus driver took it upon himself to tell the kid he couldn't do that. So at the court, there was a white gentleman with his, I think, about 8-year-old daughter. And the white gentleman had a confrontation with the black gentleman after he had admonished the kid about skateboarding. And subsequently, the white gentleman jumped on the black gentleman, according to witnesses. And when he did, the black gentleman pulled out a gun and shot him in the chest and killed him.
Right.
And at the time, they were saying there's going to be no charges against him. And then just about a week ago, I read in the paper that there is going to be a grand jury hearing of the case.
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting. People are talking about the racism. It's a very, very clear case of that as far as I can tell.
Yeah. Well, all you have to do to know that we have and thank you for the call, Bill. All you have to do to know that we have a two-tier justice system in the United States, and really within that lower tier, we've got a bifurcated one based on race, is look at the race of the people who are on death row. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls. And Nancy Altman with Social Security Works is going to drop by on Ryan's budget fiasco. I promised you we'd get to this. We've got to get to this. It's a big deal.
I'm telling you to get the doctor.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul Ryan this morning appeared on MSNBC, the Joe Scarborough Show, and they really gave him a tough grilling about what was in his legislation. Here's a clip.
First of all, we will throw you the softball question out there. Talk about how this is great because it defines the difference between Republicans and Democrats' worldview of government. How is it different? How does it define the difference?
So how it's different is we're saving Medicare from bankruptcy, preserving it for current generations and future generations.
Right.
We're
right there, Jacob. I have a certain threshold for Paul Ryan's lies, and it has already been exceeded. Nancy Altman is with us. She's the co-director of Social Security Works. StrengthenSocialSecurity.org is the website. And, Nancy, you have been, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You have been looking into, with some care and diligence, the Paul Ryan budget. What's in there?
They are seeking to end Medicare as we know it and cut back Social Security, raise its retirement age, and so forth. It's a very clever document in that they are better than last year and they're more subtle in what they do. But if you really look behind it, you see what they're after, and it really does define the difference. The difference is that they want to give tax cuts for 100 millionaires and billionaires, huge tax cuts.
$3 trillion worth of tax cuts that they're going to pay for by cutting Social Security and Medicare.
Exactly, and also Medicaid, food stamps, programs for
Pell Grants for students.
This is a sacrifice by everybody but the top 1%.
Right. This is just astounding. Clearly, this has no chance of passing the Senate. I mean, it'll probably pass the House like the last wackadoodle bill that Paul Ryan came up with to end Medicare as we know it. Two questions. One, do you think that Ron Wyden is going to make the same mistake he made last time of endorsing something that Paul Ryan is doing?
Well, it's really unfortunate. There should be a sharp difference for the voters to vote about. Poll after poll after poll shows that the American people are very clear. They're united on the issue of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They do not want these programs cut. They understand how important they are. They want those at the top to pay more. But too many of the Democrats are not making the stark contrast and are kind of giving cover to the Republicans, as you started to say, as Wyden has done with softening, you know, making it look like it's bipartisan.
Well, and now I've got conservatives coming on the program calling it the Wyden-Ryan plan. They're literally calling it that. I'm sure Frank Luntz has focus grouped it.
Well, I'm sure Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson are turning over in their graves, because these are issues that are signature programs of the Democratic Party. They created them. They are extremely successful, extremely popular. Fortunately, I don't know if you saw this, but just a week ago, the AFL-CIO has come out in favor of increasing Social Security's benefits. The women's groups are also calling for that.
Yep.
Some members of Congress are, and that's what the American people want, and that's what should happen.
Oh, I've been saying for a long time, and written several op-eds about this, that if we actually dropped the Social Security eligibility age from 65 or 66 now, I guess it is, down to 55, you would suck about half the people who are working out of the workplace, because, you know, a lot of people would retire.
Yep.
And not everybody, obviously, but a lot would, which would immediately cut unemployment and open up lots and lots of jobs for young people.
And thus
increase wages and increase people who are working, decrease the number of people who are on unemployment, and thus increase the revenue going into Social Security fund.
You're absolutely right. In fact, in the early 1960s, when the retirement age was put in, it was during a recession, and that was exactly the rationale. We should also be talking about reducing the age of eligibility for Medicare from 65 to 62.
Well, I think we should decrease that one to zero.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that. Medicare for all.
I mean, let's just make it zero.
I'm with you.
Right.
It is a program that works. It has lower administrative costs, even though it's covering people with the most expensive part of the population, seniors and people with disabilities. It's got lower administrative costs than you find in the private sector. Same with Social Security. It returns more than 99 cents of every dollar collected. The reason is there are certain things that the government, which is just all of us together, do better than the private sector, and this broad-based insurance is one of them. It's why so many other countries are able to cover their entire populations, often with better health outcomes, at half the cost.
Always with better health outcomes. We are among the bottom. Clip 8, Jacob, if you could please play. This is Paul Ryan talking about means testing.
And for younger people, give them a choice of guaranteed health care options to choose from, then subsidize that choice, meaning don't subsidize wealthy seniors. Subsidize the poor and the sick a lot more than everybody else, and don't subsidize wealthy people nearly as much as everybody else. That's different. That is change, but that saves Medicare.
Yes, right. So as soon as you take any group out of an entitlement program, out of an insurance program that covers everybody in the United States, that everybody pays into, everybody gets the benefit of, even if they're Bill Gates, as soon as you start pulling out the billionaires and the millionaires, then 5 years down the road, they say, hey, you know, why don't we pull out everybody who makes over $100,000? And then 5 years down the road, they say, hey, why don't we pull out everybody who makes over $30,000? And then a year after that, it's, why do we have this welfare program? Let's end it.
Hey, absolutely right. These programs, and this is what Representative Ryan and his colleagues failed to understand, is that these programs are insurance. They were created, in fact, you know, often people see on their payroll stubs, on their wages, FICA. That stands for the Federal Insurance Contributions Act. These are premiums that people are paying. It is not welfare, and it makes no sense to means test them.
No, but if you do means test them successfully, which is what Paul Ryan is pushing, you turn them into a welfare program.
Exactly.
And then you don't have much of a constituency to stop cutting them. I mean, when Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it and replaced it with the TAMF, you know, you must, four years and you're out and you have to work during those 4 years. I mean, that was great during a boom. Nobody really noticed. But now during a recession, that's killing people.
It is probably literally
killing people.
Well, it is.
that's what would happen to Social Security and Medicare if we were just to means test them. They would turn into welfare programs.
Exactly. We have values in this country of all of us in it together that you get reward for hard work, that you know, Social Security in many ways is conservative. You pay in on the first dollar.
You're right. Nancy, we're out of time, but brilliant. Nancy Alban, strengthensocialsecurity.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So Paul Ryan comes out and he says, okay, let's cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires. Paul Ryan himself, a multimillionaire, by $3 trillion. And we'll pay for that by cutting Social Security, turning Medicare into a voucher program, cutting Pell Grants for students. Let's just, you know, right across the board. Anything that the middle class uses, screw them. They're not rich. Trey Kovacs is with us, with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's a policy analyst and author with CEI and author of the article, Raising the Tipped Minimum Wage Does More Harm Than Good. Trey, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. What I'm seeing, though, when I look at the minimum wage going back to the 1930s when it was first put into law, is that every time the minimum wage goes up, if you look at three-year pieces, which typically is the way, you know, it takes a year or two for any kind of policy to really show up in the economy. What you see are substantial bumps, increases in GDP. That, I mean, this is kind of Econ 101. You put more money in working people's pockets, people who spend 100% of that money, and you're going to increase demand in the economy. So why don't we do what Ralph Nader is proposing right away, raise a minimum wage to $10. It would be $8.45 if it were inflation adjusted to 1960.
Well, where the flaw in that logic is that if a worker only can contribute with the skills they have $5 an hour and the minimum wage is $10, this effectively discriminates against low-skilled workers.
That's nonsense.
They'll remain low-skilled.
Trey, that is horrible. Are you suggesting that we should be a country where people who basically the skill that they have to offer is their labor? Right, people who are flipping burgers or moving furniture or whatever—the absolute lowest skill levels—that those people should have to live so far below the poverty level, $5 an hour, so far below the poverty level that there's no possible way they could possibly raise a family. There's no possible way that they could even, you know, live in a decent neighborhood or ever own a car.
Well, see, and this is the upward mobility argument, which I think people use. That when these low-skilled workers, when there's a $10 minimum wage, they'll never get skills. And when you are young and you work and it's at...
You mean because their daddy can't send them to college?
No. You gain skills at work. So if you're a low-skilled worker and you're able to become a waiter and work, you gain skills and can learn, you know, how to do, you know, administrative tasks and move up within the structure of the restaurant.
I don't think waiters learn how to do administrative tasks. They learn how to be waiters.
Representative Donna Edwards, who is the one introducing the Wage Act to increase the tip minimum wage, was a waitress. And now...
So was my wife. A lot of people did that when they were very young, but that doesn't... You know, first of all, I think we should probably separate this conversation out. Let's stipulate that we're talking about adults here.
Right.
We're talking about people over 18 or arguably over 21. I think over 18 probably is reasonable because the argument's made, oh, you know, if you jack up the minimum wage, you're going to freeze out 15-year-olds who want to mow your lawn. No, you're not. And first of all. And secondly, when we allow a business to start in the United States, We give businesses, I shouldn't say them, I have one right here, it's this radio show. I get as the owner of a small business, as an incorporated company, I get all kinds of benefits, tax benefits. I get limitations
of
liability.
I think that's not the issue right there.
I get, no, hang on just a second. I get all these benefits from my government. And presumably I get those because they want me to be in business because it'll serve the public good. Now, if that's the case, shouldn't we say part of serving the public good, part of, you know, one of the reasons why we're going to give all of these benefits to corporations is because they have to, at the very least, pay a reasonable minimum wage.
Well, I mean, I would strongly oppose giving those types of benefits to corporations because I believe in taking tax money and giving it to a corporation, essentially a special interest, cannot be in the public good.
So you don't think that I should be able to deduct the cost of my employees' salaries?
No, that's what I think. If you had a tax code that made sense and you had rates that people had to pay, you could get rid of these exemptions and minimum wage and prevailing wage laws that make it difficult for people to understand the regulations and enter into free contracts when they are adults.
So you're taking a total libertarian position. The government should play no role in any of this whatsoever. No corporate taxes, no corporate regulations.
Yeah, I mean, you can see...
That's insanity.
With a
if you want to see that, go to Somalia. I'm serious. One country. Here, Trey, I will send you a case of autographed books. If you can name one country in the history of the world, and we've got 7,000 years of civilization and capitalism to draw on, one country in the history of the world that has successfully followed your Ayn Rand libertarian idea. One.
No, but I think you're missing the point. I think that this good intention laws with minimum wage with $10, why not $20 an hour? I mean, if you're not going to consider costs.
No, well, you set it at the point where a person who has a minimal skill level can live. It should be a living wage. You know, the Republican president, Theodore Roosevelt, said, I stand for a living wage.
Well, that's what, with the tip minimum wage.
$5 an hour is not a living wage.
But the tip minimum wage is not $5 an hour. It's $7.25.
$7.25 isn't a living wage.
Well,
you can't live on that anywhere in America. You know, Walmart on average is paying their employees a little under $10, and you know there's been a dozen studies done on Walmarts in communities all around America where they found that if people bought everything that they needed at Walmart, they still couldn't afford to live on a Walmart salary. People have to go on public assistance. People work for Walmart and they have to go on Medicaid because they don't have enough money to pay for their health bills. They have to get subsidized housing because they don't have enough money to pay their rent. They end up on food stamps because they're making so little. We should not be subsidizing Walmart. We should be saying to Walmart and any other business, if you can't pay a wage that people can live on in this country, you have no damn right to be doing business in this country. We're going to shut you down.
Well, I mean, I think more so if you started taking away all the subsidies and the benefits these corporations got, people would pay less taxes, people would have cheaper goods, and people wouldn't need as much as...
No, come on. Give me a break. The five Walmart heirs have more aggregated wealth than 30% of Americans combined. 30% of Americans. Five people. 100 million Americans. Five people. Those five people have more wealth than that 100 million Americans, and it all came from Walmart. And you're telling me that if we simply did away with corporate income taxes on Walmart, that somehow it's going to reduce prices for all the rest of us and help us out? Nonsense. Those five Waltonaires are going to make more money.
These energy guarantee loans, you stop giving all tax exemptions, you stop letting GE pay no corporate taxes every year, you would start getting revenue from corporations.
So now you want GE to pay corporate taxes?
Of course. I mean,
if
there's a corporate tax that they're supposed to pay and that there's a rate, I mean, there has to be tax. I'm not against government and against all taxes. But have a rate. If you're going to have a corporate tax rate at 35%,
but that's got nothing to do with the minimum wage. Why can't we simply say if you can't do business in this country at a living wage, you have no right to do business?
Because I don't think it's the government's position to intervene.
It's not the government. It's us.
Contracting.
It absolutely is. Who enforces those contracts, Trey?
The government, but that's what why
and whose court system is used, and so it's our skin in the game.
Should I not be able to work for $5 an hour if that's all the work I can find and I want $5 an hour? Should should anyone be able to tell me I cannot do that?
I think that somebody should be able to tell an employer. Yes, I think government should tell an employer, if you're going to try and hire people for $5 an hour, if you're going to create a race to the bottom, if we as a government are going to incentivize you to create a class of the working poor, we're not going to do that.
If you take away the incentives for the corporations and you quit government intervention, then I think
you're making the same argument that's made in favor of child labor. Trey Kovacs, CEI.org. You can read Trey's piece over at CEI.org. Thanks, Trey.
All right, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So we'll be back. I want to go through Paul Ryan's thing here a little bit. Actually, in general, the insanity that America's sliding into, that's what I want to get into.
There's one who takes it all, and there's one who takes the fall. One who never wins, and there's one who stands again.
20 minutes past the hour, talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back.
Crimes, making money, selling lies.
You might say everybody hates my
guts. Our rush alert for the day. Given the exodus of advertisers from the Limbaugh show, one group wanted to take advantage. The Westboro Baptist Church, the infamous super radical church group that bases its teaching off of a, quote, God hates fags, end quote, premise. This is what their signs all say. Wanted to put an ad on Limbaugh's program. A spokesman said that the church agreed with Rush's ideas, especially when it came to labeling Sandra Fluck a slut. However, a spokesman for Rush's show said that they would not be airing the ads. Interesting to note that the church's entire premise is wrong and is actually based on a typographic error. Nowhere in the Bible did God say that he hates gays, or specifically, to use the Westboro Baptist Church's slur, fags. Instead, God said he hated figs. He did it four times. For example, Jeremiah 29:17, behold, I will send upon them the sword, the famine, and the pestilence, and will make them like vile figs that cannot be eaten. They are so evil. Yes, that's a quote from the Bible. So really, the Westboro Baptist Church should be scared straight by the evil figs, not by gay people. For more information on Westboro's hatred of figs, check out GodHatesFigs.org. Yes, God hates figs, figs.org. I think you'll like it. All righty. Virginia in Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Hartford, Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky. I'm sorry. Did I say?
That's all right.
Yeah, okay. So what's up?
I worked for Walmart back in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And no matter what they would pay you, the way they do the hours, there's no way you can make a living there.
Yeah, or any place else that pays these kind of, you know, just at or just above minimum wage wages.
Excellent. I started out as a cashier there
mm-hmm.
when I started, and then I was moved to the shoe department. And they only give you anywhere from 23 hours and less.
Right, so you don't qualify
for
benefits.
If you're a single mother trying to raise a child, no way.
Yeah.
And with all this stuff they're going on with,
mm-hmm.
they need to try and live on that kind of a wage for at least a year.
Yeah.
With no other means of getting out of any money.
Yep, I totally agree with you. Virginia,
thank
you very much for the call, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV there in Kentucky. Eric in Los Angeles. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hello. Hey, I wanted to mention about the Trayvon Martin case and this Stand Your Ground law.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that that should work both ways. In other words, the person who should have felt threatened was Trayvon Martin because a large man was following him.
With a gun.
And by Stand Your Ground, he should be able to then turn around and confront George Zimmerman saying, why are you threatening me by following me?
Right.
So it should work both ways.
Yeah, although, you know, he was frightened and he ran, and armed with his Skittles and his can of iced tea. And
exactly my point. He's the one who's being threatened, not the other way around.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Grant in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Grant, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for doing all that you do for us working guys out here. And I'm sorry it's noisy in here, but I got to be somewhere. You know how that is.
That's fine. Yeah, I do.
I've got two things for you here. I heard you debating that libertarian who wants all of us to, like you said, race to the bottom. The thing that kills me is I know some people like that in my personal life and professional life. And they've never served in the military. They've never worked for $5 an hour. and they don't think twice about driving somebody else into the ditch, but they sure wouldn't go down there with you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, tragically, yes, I do.
And my wife never worked outside. I've been married 30 years, and she never worked outside of our home until November of 2008. Now that our kids are grown. She works for the schools up in Tulsa where I live, and she's making $8.51 an hour for anybody who thinks that all those school employees are overpaid. She made $10,197 last year.
Yeah.
For all those people who think school employees are overpaid.
Right. And try
and
living on that.
Cut back.
Yeah, try
yeah,
living on
if
that.
If it wasn't for me, we wouldn't even have a place to live. And I'm not bragging. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying.
No, I got
but
it.
But you can't live off what people are paying. And
no.
I'm glad that somebody like you knows that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Grant. Well said. And you're absolutely right. David in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, David, what's up?
Great. Thanks, Tom. I wanted to address the situation, the Reaganomics, trickle-down economics that
sure.
Your guest was talking about. What do you think about this? What if we put tax brackets on what people pay their employees? Like, say they pay their average employees $50,000. Let's just say they made five times that. You could have one tax bracket for that. But if you made 10 times that, we'd set you on a higher tax bracket. I mean, we need the revenue.
Yeah. If individual company owners were making those kinds of decisions, then, you know, you might be able to organize some tax code incentive for them. But frankly, the strongest incentive is the one that we had from 1935 until 1982 or 83 when Reagan dropped the top tax rate from 74% down to 28%. And that was a top tax rate of 74%. The very wealthy people and the CEOs looked at that tax rate and they said, okay, if I make $100,000 in today's dollars, I pay, you know, 15%, 20%, 25%, whatever it is. If I make, you know, $300,000, I pay 30%. If I make $500,000, I pay 40%. But when I start making $1 million a year and anything over that, I'm paying 74%. That's stupid. I'm just going to take $1 million. And so for 40 years in America, for four decades or five decades, arguably, because, you know, this really didn't sink in until the middle of the Reagan administration. For 50 years, you had the average CEO in America, the average rich guy in America, making only 30 times what his average employee made, because to make more than that meant you were in the 74 or 91% tax bracket, which was crazy. And that's the most effective way to do it. And you just do it right across the board. And, you know, no more guys like John Paulson making $2 billion a year on Wall Street and paying a maximum 15% income tax on. David, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How can we bring back an America that actually works after all the damage that 30 years of Reaganomics has done? And now Paul Ryan trying to make it worse.
Wasting time in the unemployment lines. Sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. And no, we don't need Paul Ryan's revolution. We need to call me a counter-revolutionary, but I'd like to see the end of the Reagan revolution. The minimum wage. Here was a hearing. Three Missouri Republicans are trying to take on Senator Claire McCaskill, the Democrat from Missouri. And it was a radio debate. And the topic of the minimum wage came up. Here's what happened.
Okay, do you know what the minimum wage is?
No, sir.
Okay, how about you, Sarah Steelman?
$7.50 an hour.
Are you in favor of increasing it or decreasing it? Are you in favor of increasing it?
No, I'm not in favor of increasing it at this time.
And can you, any explanation?
Well, I think it's high enough as it is.
Right, yeah, the minimum wage. It's high enough as it is, and it's not $7.50, it's $7.25. Oh, man. Republicans, right? Can't live with them, I could live without them, I suppose. Anyway, Annalisa in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Annalisa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, Tom, would you do me a favor and post behind you and let it run every day, day after day, the exact Paul Ryan's budget proposal so people can see it? And see where he wants to take it and what he wants to do. But this is the thing I wanted to tell you. About 50 years ago, when I was a senior in high school, I went to work at Macy's as part-time temporary Christmas help, right, because in those days there were no sales before Christmas. So for a wonderful 10% discount on anything I wanted to buy for Christmas presents, I worked for 6 weeks, 20 hours a week, and would you believe it, in addition to getting 3 full days of training and a little mirror and a comb to keep myself groomed, I also had full Blue Cross Blue Shield coverage.
Yep.
For the temporary worker. That's how far we've come.
I do believe it. And in fact, you know, I can tell those stories. I mean, my mom, when my dad was off, you know, World War II, or actually it was after World War II, he was part of the occupation forces, but he joined the Army during World War II. Just didn't get out of basic training before it ended. So he was sent off to Japan, and this was before my parents were married. My mom worked her way through college at Michigan State University. Her mother, her father had died when she was 13. Her family was wiped out in the Great Depression. Her mom worked as the town clerk in Charlevoix, did not have a huge salary. And so my grandmother could not provide anything to my mom for the cost of going to college. And my mother did a full 4 years and graduated magna cum laude from MSU by, in the summertime, working as a lifeguard in Charlevoix. And through the rest of the year, on weekends when she was in college, cleaning, washing, and propping airplanes at the Lansing Airport, you know, just basic grunt work. And and not only did she earn enough money to pay her way through college and to pay for living in the dorm, not only did she earn enough to do that with this just basic part-time work, because back then the top tax rate, the top income tax rate was 91%, so the millionaires and billionaires didn't take all the money, which left a lot of money for the middle class. Not only was she able to do that, but you know, she got the education. I mean, college education was inexpensive because it was being subsidized by our government. And the land-grant college, MSU is a land-grant college. Those were started by Abraham Lincoln as free colleges. So not exactly the idea that Reagan had, but... And my wife Louise worked her way through college, working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. You could do that then, and you can't do that anymore. And it's a tragedy. It's just a tragedy. Our economy has been turned upside down ever since Ronald Reagan came into office. Annalisa, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. Tom in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Yeah, I read part of a study by a professor. I think his first name was George, but it was George Gerbner, I think it was. He did a study, and he entitled it the Mean World Syndrome, and he explained how the media drives the racial fear and hysteria. And he really never mentioned the NRA at all, from what I remember, but especially the local media, which reinforces racial stereotypes.
Sure, sure.
And so more what we need nationally is what we need is an agenda or an agendaless media.
Well, we need a media that actually tells the story. I mean, you know, people say, oh, why doesn't the media tell the good news? Well, because there's no money in it. I mean, how much, you know, people are not going to turn on the evening news to discover that the murder rate now is lower than it's been since the Reagan presidency. And
well, we want to change anything, though, Tom. I mean, we need the facts. We don't need any bias anymore is what we need.
Right. I agree.
We're looking for change. And one little spot of levity. Since I've been watching your show, I've heard the word Coke so many times, I switched to Pepsi.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
And we should point out that those Koch brothers spell their name K-O-C-H. Which some people would pronounce Koch or other ways, but they pronounce it Coke. Mike in Pocatello, Idaho. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Boy, I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'd like to share with you a trip I took to Australia. I've been to Canada, New Zealand. And while I was in Australia, I found out about their Medicare. They have no family bankruptcies there.
That's
for
right.
Medical bills.
It's free health care. I have used it. The last time I was in Australia, I got very, very sick from food poisoning out in the outback, and I just walked into a doctor's office, into a hospital, you know, one of these little doc in the box clinics, and they saw me in 15 minutes, and I mean, it's just amazing. Just amazing.
Yes,
and it was like as an out of country guy, I think I paid $15, maybe it was 20.
But, that's correct. Yeah, we're getting hoodwinked here. The thing I like to share with you on the minimum wage, when we were on the trip, the tour guide explained to us that they have a minimum living wage law in Australia.
Yes.
Whereas when you're 15 years old, you make $7 an hour, and it's graduated depending on your age. And at age 21, it's $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they've recognized is they want to get the kids out of the house, have them get a car, and get on their own, and they've done it through this minimum living wage.
Yes, and I can tell you, back in the 60s when I was a teenager, and I'm dating myself here, but the first job that I ever had was at a Henry hamburger stand, and I was either 14 or 15 years old. I think I was 15. And at that time, it was illegal for you to work if you were under 16 unless you got what was called a work permit. At least this was in the state of Michigan. And so I had to go down to a local office. I forget which office it was. I'm going far away. And I had my father sign a paper saying that I had permission from my family to work part-time. And Henry's Hamburgers couldn't hire me for any more than, I think it was 20 hours a week was the most that you could work if you were under 16. And I had to have this work permit in order to do that. But I was paid, my recollection is I was paid $2.10 an hour. It was very little, which back then was probably the equivalent of, you know, $6 or $8 an hour now. But it was basically, it was walking around money for a kid in junior high school. And, you know, I have no objection to that, you know, to that in the workforce. But I think Australia's got it right. You know, as you get older and your skill sets opens up and your need for full-time employment becomes real, the wages should be, you know, decent wages.
Well, that's correct. Yes, and I notice that the young people, they can travel, they can do things. There's all these little shops that sell the Chinese stuff, but you don't see a lot of big box stores. So they manage their economy there. The people actually manage their economy.
Yeah, they do. They do. They enforce their antitrust laws in Australia. Mike,
And by the way, if you don't vote, you get fined.
Yes, which is why they have a 95 or 98% voting compliance. It's like a traffic ticket, but it starts escalating really rapidly after the first time you miss your vote. Well said, Mike. Thanks. And they also have instant runoff voting there. So there's multiple political parties, even though they have the same kind of political system we have, where it's first past the post, winner take all elections. Brody in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Brody, what's up?
Tom, how you doing?
Good. Hope the same is true of you.
I'm sorry, what?
I hope the same is true of you. What's on your mind?
I was just wondering if there was a way to enforce antitrust laws like without splitting, you know, like a company like Walmart actually into competing firms. Couldn't they just subsidize local, you know, state banks that would subsidize or loan to local businesses and just have a local kind of
You wouldn't want that to happen. And I'm no libertarian, right? but that would require a level of government micromanagement of business that would make business and government both untenable. I think the very, very simple solution is to do what Teddy Roosevelt and Howard Taft did, William Howard Taft, I think is his name, which is break up the big corporations. They broke up Standard Oil into 29 separate companies. And, you know, Esso and Chevron and all these other, I mean, we still have some remnants of them. And it worked. When Jimmy Carter and Richard Nixon, actually Nixon's initiated the process, when Nixon and Ford and Carter broke up AT&T into 8 or 9 companies, plus Bell Labs, it became Lucent Technologies. If you owned AT&T stock before the breakup, after the breakup, that stock became all, you know, you owned little pieces of all of those companies, your value, your equity actually increased. The value of the companies increased. It kicked off a revolution. Brody, thank you for the call. It kicked off a revolution in telecommunications in the United States. The antitrust laws are there for a really simple reason. It's not that big corporations are evil or big corporations are bad or a country shouldn't have big corporations. It's that when corporations get so large that they can dominate a marketplace, or a small handful, 3 or 4 of them can dominate a marketplace, then you end up with an anti-competitive situation, a monopolistic situation. And when you end up in a situation where there's monopoly, there's a lack of competition, there's a lack of innovation, and you have higher prices. There's a reason why in France, where they enforce the antitrust laws, you can get 100 channels of TV plus 100 MIP download internet plus free cell phone service for $35 a month. In the United States, it costs $200.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because in France, there's over 100 companies you can select from. It's very simple. We need competition. We need to stop what Reagan did in 82 when he stopped the enforcement of the Sherman Act.
Move around, move around, move around, all around, all around.
Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Victoria.
Hello.
So Paul Ryan is doing his Dog and Pony Act. This morning, he and Joe Scarborough were basically French kissing on TV.
Yes.
And I'm assuming it's continued along those lines, given how much the big media corporations that run most of our media love the idea of tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
Well, there has been some of that. I've had to turn it off. I stay away from some of that. I've been getting some of my news from print, an old-fashioned medium that some of us favor.
Okay.
And I read, as a matter of fact, a statement from the White House on the Ryan Republican budget, which is pretty scathing.
And can you summarize it for us?
Yeah, I can. Fails the balance of fairness, balance, and shared responsibility, showers the wealthiest few Americans with tax cuts, preserving taxpayer giveaways to oil companies, tax breaks for hedge fund managers. What's worse, the rest of these tax breaks paid for by undermining Medicare and the things we need to grow the economy. And instead of strengthening Medicare, ends Medicare as we know it. That's the start.
Yeah.
And it continues.
And it's spot on. I don't understand how Republicans think that they can win an election by putting forward a budget that cuts the taxes of millionaires and billionaires by $3 trillion and then pays for it by cutting benefits to people who are on Medicare, Social Security, students who are getting Pell Grants, but it wipes all this stuff out. I just don't understand how they think they can do this.
There was a lack of specificity in that budget that I think that Ryan is probably hoping will save him. Mm. What is interesting about this budget is that, of course, it's not going to get through the Senate, so it's ultimately going nowhere.
Right.
But it may not even get through his own budget committee tomorrow.
Whoa! I assumed when he rolled this thing out that it had at least gone through the budget committee. Just for our listeners who don't know, in the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan is a congressman, not a senator, and in the House of Representatives, there is a committee that does the first pass on the budget, and that's the budget committee, and Paul Ryan is the head of that committee. So, to you.
Right. So tomorrow there is going to be a hearing on this, and there is going to be a markup on the resolution tomorrow, and he's going to need near unified Republican support to pass it out of committee, and it's not clear if he has the votes. It's assumed that all the Democrats are going to vote no.
Sure. Well, of course they are. But if two Republicans vote no, he's lost it, right?
Right. Three Republicans they're concerned about, and it's hardline conservatives. They don't like the $1.08 trillion spending level. They don't like the amount of time that it takes to balance the budget, which is about 25 years. They think it's too long. So they've got a rebellion on their hands, which they're going to try and quell between now and tomorrow.
Paul Ryan is being attacked from his right? I didn't think there was a right to Paul Ryan.
Well, apparently so.
Amazing. Amazing. So the Tea Partiers are going to take him down. Okay, so what else is going on?
Well, other thing going on, Supreme Court, again, this time pondering life without parole for juveniles.
Yes, these 14-year-old killers.
14-year-old killers. They heard the arguments today. And Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the earlier opinions ruling out the death penalty, one in 2005 and then another one 2 years ago.
Right.
So there are two cases, both 14, one in which the killer did not pull the trigger, so he's not technically the killer, it was attempted robbery. And the other one, the young man, had actually attempted suicide six times. First time when he was as young as five, he was so badly abused as a child. There are 79 people in prison for crimes that took place when they were 14 or younger. So Kennedy was one of several justices who appeared to be troubled by the lack of flexibility in sentencing young killers.
Yes.
And he seemed to indicate he might favor a ruling that gives judges a role in determining an appropriate sentence, quote, that the sentence cannot be mandatory, but that in some cases it might still be imposed.
Right. And in fact, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that the case of the child that is before them, he wasn't even the trigger man. He was simply there at the scene of the crime. The trigger man was 2 years older than him, 16 years old, cut a deal with the prosecutors to testify against the 14-year-old. The 14-year-old got life in prison without parole. The 16-year-old got life in prison with eligible for parole in 15 years, I think.
That's right. That's right. He got the short straw.
Right.
And the trigger man didn't.
Right. Ever since Reagan started promoting these three strikes you're out laws and minimum mandatory sentencing back in the 80s, it has seemed to me like pandering to the worst of our fears. And we have a judicial system because we want our judges to make Solomonic decisions, reasonable, thoughtful, informed decisions based on the merits of the case and the people before them. And I agree with Kennedy, if he's taking this position, that legislatures should not be usurping the role of a judge or a jury.
So. And I think that's what we don't know which way they're going to go on this. It was probably going to be a tight one.
Yeah.
Scalia and Alito probably siding with the states on this. Don't know what everybody else is going to do. I'd imagine Thomas would side with the states too.
Yeah.
But there were some interesting questions asked, probably a decision by the summer.
Yeah. This is all about the 7th or 8th Amendment, the cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So.
Also, a Republican primary today in Illinois. Expect Mitt Romney to do well. He's about 14.5 points ahead of Rick Santorum. He's also starting to poll better with the very conservative. Rick Santorum is now also telling Barack Obama how to parent.
Oh, my. He wants Barack Obama to homeschool his kids?
No, he's telling him that he shouldn't have sent Malia to Oaxaca in Mexico on vacation because it's not safe and the State Department advises against it, but the State Department does not.
So Rick just pulled something out of his left ear.
Yes.
Okay. Surprise, surprise. Rick Santorum, never use a prompter. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Up next, you can't have a middle class without big government. No, seriously.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our third hour. Republicans in Congress, well, actually, a Republican in Congress. It turns out he doesn't even have his entire committee with him. Paul Ryan. Yes, Mr. End Welfare as we know it. Paul Ryan laid out his vision for America today. In a pretty disgusting French kissing session with Joe Scarborough this morning on MSNBC, he basically said, well, I'll get to that. If Paul Ryan succeeds, the 99% of us are basically condemned to live like serfs. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, himself a multimillionaire, released his blueprint budget for fiscal year 2013, which includes massive cuts to food stamps, student loans, Medicaid, and Social Security. The budget also dismantles Medicare as we know it, transforming an insurance program into a voucher program, leaving millions of senior citizens on their own to deal with for-profit health insurance companies. And in a nod to the Republican Party's super-rich members like himself, Ryan proposes enormous tax breaks for the 1%, lowering the top income tax rate from 35% down to 25%. Oh, that's going to be just great, isn't it? We had a strong and powerful and vibrant middle class when the top tax rate for millionaires and billionaires was 91%. 30 to 1 was the top ratio that you saw of CEO pay to worker pay. Reagan dropped that down to 28%, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. Millionaires and billionaires went to 1,000 to 1, 10,000 to 1 in some industries, what they're making versus what their employees are making. The rich got richer, the poor got poorer, the minimum wage became worth less and less. Anyhow, according to the Tax Policy Center, Ryan's budget would give $3 trillion in tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans, all paid for by cutting spending on education, health care, and Medicare. Congressman Ryan said about his budget, this is an actual quote. Listen carefully. He said, it's up to the people to demand a choice between two futures. The question is, which future will you choose? End quote. That is the question. He's right on that. You know, he's wrong on everything else, but he's right on that. We have to choose the future in which we want. Do we want a future in which we have a middle class again, that it can thrive in America like it did for 50 years after the New Deal until Ronald Reagan blew everything up? Or are we going to choose Paul Ryan's path to an Ayn Rand dystopia in which only the super wealthy can go to good schools and see doctors and everyone else is left with what trickles off the edge of the table of the rich? You know, we used to have an American dream in this country. The American dream was not, someday I'll win a lottery. Or someday I'll, invent a software product and become a billionaire. No, that wasn't the American dream. The American dream was that if you worked hard and kept your nose clean, you could raise your family, buy a house and a car, take an annual vacation, have health coverage, and safely retire with a comfortable nest egg. Teddy Roosevelt laid this out in the 19-aughts and teens, the Republican Roosevelt. He said, I stand for not a minimum wage, a living wage. And then he went on to say, a living wage is determined by industrial conditions locally, right? In other words, it varies from place to place in the country. But it has to have a certain minimum components. And then he goes through the list. It has to be enough to care for your family in times of sickness and in health. In other words, pay for health care. It needs to be enough to provide for a vacation. And it needs to be enough to provide for morality, he said. In other words, you don't have to steal for your food. Because literally, people had to steal food back then. And enough to provide for a decent retirement in old age. Here's Teddy Roosevelt from more than 100 years ago, a recording personally made by Thomas Alva Edison.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible, to provide for education and recreation, to care for immature members of the family, to maintain the family during periods of sickness, and to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
There you go. A living wage. And a living wage includes health care and vacations and retirement. And that was over 100 years ago. And it has been fought tooth and nail by Republicans ever since. Even though Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. He ultimately became not a Republican anymore. Just like Jim Jeffords. Okay, this party has gone nuts. I'm out of here. He started the Bull Moose Party. But the American dream was made possible by one thing, big government. Now, big government in the United States is a kind of funny word because, you know, our government represents about 20, 21, 22% of our GDP in the United States, depending on the year. And in Canada, the government represents over half of the GDP. In virtually every developed country in the world, government represents between 50 and 65% of GDP. Here it's 21%. And we call this big government? So first of all, you get that the whole idea, that this whole phrase big government is simply a right-wing buzzword that has no meaning. We don't have a big government. We have a government half the size of any other developed country in the world to begin with. Why is it half the size? Because if we doubled the size of government, we could give everybody the right to health care and free public education all the way up to MD, PhD, which all the other governments do in variations. But that big government that the conservatives are so hysterical about that they want to destroy, which seems fundamentally anti-American to me, doesn't it to you? I mean, government is the United States. This is what This is what the founders, you know, 56 people signed the Declaration of Independence, and literally, you know, they said we pledge our, I forget the exact language, but it's brilliant. In fact, let me read it to you, because this is what these guys did. They knew that when they signed the Declaration of Independence, they were literally signing their own death warrants. And they literally did. They were all sentenced to be hung by the neck till dead by King George. By King George the third by that point. He said, at the very end, "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And they did. Half of them were wiped out by the war. So big government protected Reich workers' rights to unionize, so those jobs paid well and had decent benefits. Big government imposed trade regulations and import tariffs to keep manufacturing jobs here in the U.S., making a middle class possible. Big government provided free public school education to everybody in America, at least until Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Department of Education, the guy who had wanted to scrap the Department of Education. Big government was the employer of last resort in the 30s and 40s and brought us out of the Great Depression. Big government sent an entire generation of young men through college for free with the GI Bill in the 1950s, the way my dad went to college. Provided free or nearly free college education in states from California to New York before Reagan ended it when he became the governor of California and then nationwide as president. Government provides the legal and financial framework for companies to work through limitations of liability on incorporation, special tax breaks for corporations, stable monetary system. Government provides businesses with an educated workforce, good roads, rails, transportation, airplanes, airports, safe streets, protected by police and firefighters. We need it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Those programs, that government is what made the American dream possible, and it's those programs that Paul Ryan wants to slash. We can't let it.
Doctor, my eyes.
Speaking of the truth, multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Ralph Nader gave a talk to a group of people here in Washington, D.C. the other day, and he had some really, really good points. He said, stop using the word privatize. Start using the word corporatize. That's very wise. He said, never use the phrase private sector. Call it the corporate sector. It's not the private sector. It's the corporate sector. Stop referring to white-collar crime. It's not white-collar crime. It's corporate crime. And instead of talking about poor people getting entitlements, let's talk about the corporate entitlements. I am with you, Mr. Nader. David, in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I really like watching your program because you're one of the few that actually makes an effort to talk about facts.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about tariffs. From like 1890 to like 1929, we had like between 25 and 37% tariffs.
Yeah, it's actually a longer period than that. In 1789, George Washington was made president of the United States. That's when our republic started. And his old friend Henry Knox rode up to him. He was literally outstanding in his field. And Henry Knox rode up on a horse from New York City and said, "You have been made president of the United States, and in 30 days they want you in New York City to be sworn in across from Wall Street, on Wall Street, where the capital of the United States was at that time." And George Washington said, "Okay, fine, there's two things I want to do. I want to say goodbye to my mother, because she's dying," and he did, and she did. And then he said, "Also, I want you to ride on your horse up to Connecticut to the offices of," and I'd have to dig out a copy of my Rebooting the American Dream to get the guy's name, but there was a guy who was the only man in America who was making fine clothing for men, because it had been illegal before the Revolutionary War. The British had made it illegal. It all had to be imported from England. And he said, "I want you to go up and get an American suit to my measurements made by this guy in time for me to get sworn in." And he was sworn in an American suit. And then when he became president in 1789, he said to Alexander Hamilton, his Secretary of the Treasury, "Give me a plan so that we can build American manufacturing in the United States." Hamilton worked on that for a year and a half and produced it in the summer of 1791. and it was called his 11-point report on manufacturers. You can Google it, Hamilton's report on manufacturers. You can read the whole thing. First third of it is his debate with Jefferson about whether America should be an agrarian nation. But then he gets down to brass tacks, and I reprinted that in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, where he says, here's the 11-point plan. Step number one, put import tariffs on manufactured goods coming into this country. And then there's a whole bunch of other things, you know, support R&D and all these other things. And so we started in, and then Congress and the president, through presidential orders and congressional action, by 1793, we had tariffs on imported goods in the United States that averaged in the low, in the high 20%. And from 1793 until the Reagan administration, we had tariffs that averaged between 25 and 40% continuously. They peaked, you know, sometimes, and they dipped sometimes, but the average was around 31, 32, 33% during that entire period of time, from the Washington administration to the Reagan administration. Reagan began dropping the tariffs, and by the time the Clinton administration was done with it, the tariffs were down to 2.2%. They're now at a little under 2.1%, and thus we don't have jobs in America anymore.
Well,
sorry,
I
for
mean,
the history lesson, but
no,
you got me started, David. One of my favorite topics.
Well, we were growing really well.
We did. Like, it built America. You know, it built America.
And the whole keep hammering on Reagan, by the way, because he was only a little bit smarter than Sarah Palin.
It all started with Reagan. I have the website. It all began with Reagan.com, and it all started with Reagan.com. My wife threatens to put it on my tombstone.
I know you said it before, but he also added $2 trillion to the national debt.
He did. He tripled the national debt.
But is anybody in Congress talking about this or trying to do something about tariffs?
The only people that I have heard...
With $2 Mexicans or 75 cent Chinese?
Right. The only people that I have heard talk about changing our trade policy in order to bring manufacturing back to the United States are Bernie Sanders and Sherrod Brown. There are probably others... That you know are looking at this. In fact, I would guess probably the entire Progressive Caucus, which is 90 some odd members of Congress. But the Bernie will just come right out and say it. Most politicians, this is still radioactive, and the reason why it's radioactive is because it was a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, who really who pushed through NAFTA and GATT. He agreed with George Herbert Walker Bush on this, and I think history has shown that Ross Perot was actually right. And Clinton has in the years since then expressed some regrets for that. Or at least how it's played out. I don't think it didn't work out the way he expected it to. I think Clinton did this with the very best of intentions. And then George Bush made it even worse, the most recent George Bush. So because it was a bipartisan effort, and you've got Thomas Friedman out there, who's supposedly a liberal writing for the New York Times, writing entire books about how free trade is so important and so necessary, it has become something that Democrats are afraid to grab hold of. For fear they'll get shocked. And I think it's a legitimate fear that the big transnational corporations that are the only beneficiaries of free trade, our nation has not benefited, the middle class has not benefited, the working class has not benefited. The only people who have benefited from global free trade, from the United States dropping all our trade barriers by ending our tariffs functionally, the only people who have benefited are the billionaires who make their money with transnational corporations and the transnational corporations themselves. And tragically, they now pretty much run the world.
And don't forget the banks that help finance
all the
foreign countries.
Yeah, and not only that, then in January of 2010, the Supreme Court said, oh, by the way, those transnational corporations, they can decide whether or not a politician gets elected by dumping millions of dollars into the campaigns. You had Elizabeth Warren just kicking Scott Brown's butt all over the state of Massachusetts back in November of last year. In December, Karl Rove comes into the state, drops a few million bucks in the Boston television market in ads calling Elizabeth Warren a tool of the banks, and all of a sudden Scott Brown is up 9 points over Elizabeth Warren. He swung the polls 18 points in 2 months simply with a few million dollars in negative ads and untruthful ads at that. That's what corporate money can do, and that's what it's going to do in this next election if we don't all stand up and speak out loudly. David, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching us in Hershey, Pennsylvania. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, more of your calls and the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word ugly right after this. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very valetudinariously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good! Senate Democrats are again trying to repeal the tax incentives given to big oil. Senator Menendez of New Jersey introduced a bill Monday that would eliminate incentives for big oil and use the additional revenue to help fund renewable energy sources. The bill would repeal around $2 billion in big oil welfare. Big oil rakes in billions of dollars in profits every year. They certainly don't need any more of our money. The money saved by cutting back on incentives can be used to invest in the green tech and renewable energy sources that this country desperately needs. Let's hope Senate Dems can push this bill along. The bad. Ricky Santorum, campaigning in Illinois yesterday. Don't Google me, Santorum told a crowd of supporters, I don't care what the unemployment rate's going to be. Okay, let me get this straight. Mr. Santorum wants to be president of a country dealing with a struggling economy, yet he doesn't care about one of the biggest issues keeping that economy down, millions of Americans across the country unemployed, barely able to get by day to day. They need someone who's going to get them back to work so that they can survive, not someone who's going to write them off. Like, we need another reason to see that conservatives are out of touch with America. And the very, very ugly, the Chicago Police Department. Two members of the Chicago television station were told by an irritable cop Sunday that, quote, your First Amendment rights can be terminated if you're creating a scene or whatever, end quote. The reporters were outside of a hospital trying to cover the shooting death of a little girl. Police officer continued to threaten the reporters with arrest if they didn't leave and eventually detained them but let them out without any charges. Journalists all over the nation are increasingly subjected to the use of excessive force by police. Freedom of the press is one of the pillars that America is built on, and police trying to crack down on such a fundamental right? Very, very ugly. Carol in Douglasville, Texas. Hey, Carol, what's on your mind today?
Oh, just about the price of education.
Uh-huh. You're talking about the story I told about my mom going to college by working as a lifeguard?
That's right. That's right. I worked in the shipyard for 2.5 months at 74 cents an hour and saved enough to go to the University of Texas for a couple of semesters.
Yep. Carol, from the founding of this country up until the Reagan administration, you could work part-time and save enough money to pay for a college education. And a lot of people did. And then, you know, the wheels came off. Reagan put Bill Bennett in charge of the Education Department, a man who had campaigned for president on the platform of destroying the Department of Education. And they started profitizing public education and started cutting back on the land-grant colleges that Abraham Lincoln invented and the University of Virginia that was founded by Thomas Jefferson as a free college for anybody who could qualify. Excellent story. Carol, thank you for sharing it with us.
And all right. Enjoy your show, Tom.
Thank you, Carol. I appreciate it. And for validating it. I'm guessing you must be, you know, in the neighborhood of my mom's age or you know, what she would be if she was still alive. Shane in Lugoff, South Carolina. Hey, Shane, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Lugoff.
Lugoff, I'm sorry.
That's fine. Yeah, my ex-girlfriend was a waitress. I had a question about the minimum wage because I know she makes like $2.15 an hour.
Yep.
But I'm trying to understand if the minimum wage goes up, like if all of her waitresses were paid minimum wage, which would up their wage, you know, $5 an hour.
Which is the law, by the way, in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, even for waitresses?
That's correct. Specifically for waiters and waitresses, yes.
Well, good.
And bartenders.
I see that increasing the price of the food and the service or whatever.
Didn't in Portland.
Whatever, you know, they've got to pass the cost on somewhere. How does that,
the cost of your service help is such a minute fragment of the cost of running a restaurant. The cost of, you know, your rent is high, your advertising is high. Your kitchen facilities, you've got, you know, $500,000 worth of equipment, hardware, stuff that's breaking down, needs to be fixed. You've got insurance costs. You got bookkeeper costs. You got all these other costs. The cost of the people who are who are out there serving the patrons is such a small percentage of the overall cost of running a business, running a restaurant business, that in Portland, and I lived there, you know, I'm telling you this from personal experience, but I'm sure you can Google this very easily because there was a big controversy about it. In Portland, when they passed a law that said that you have to pay minimum wage, and the state minimum wage, by the way, in Oregon is, I think, a buck higher than the federal minimum wage. It might be a buck and a half higher, but it's higher than the federal minimum wage. You have to pay that minimum wage to people who work for tips. And then on top of that, they make their tips. And what it did was it upgraded the quality of the service in the restaurants, which I think probably brought more people into the restaurants.
What I'm trying to figure out is how do they pay for the extra cost without increasing the prices that I'm paying, like when I go out to eat or something?
They probably did increase the price, and it was probably something on the order of 10 or 12 cents for a meal, and you wouldn't notice it.
We were talking about this because I couldn't believe until I met her how ridiculously poor waitresses are.
Yeah.
But it seemed, which I think is another side, but yeah, I mean, we made it seem like it was going to be a buck or two more per person. Every time you went out.
No, I'm guessing, although every single one of our lines right now is slammed, so nobody can call in. All 12 lines are lit up, but I'm guessing that probably if any lines pop open or maybe tomorrow people will call in from Portland because we're on the air there on AM 620 KPOJ. Telling their stories, because inevitably this happens, of being waiters and waitresses. You can you can make a decent, not a decent living, not the old factory jobs kind of living, but you can survive on it. And
if you don't claim your tips, that's about the only way you can survive.
Yeah, well, but see, you still make the good tips, plus you're making your $8 an hour or whatever it is as a base, and so it's not so bad. I mean, a lot of people, depending on the restaurant, you know, in the lower-end restaurants, you know, trying to get up to that $8 or $10 or $12 an hour is tough. But, Shane, thanks a lot for the call. You need to check out Portland. It's a beautiful city, too. Ron in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yes, I heard you speaking earlier, and you were talking about how you were astounded by the fact that the Republicans were going to run on all they're going to run on and expect to win an election. And the one point I have is that's true, but really what's really even more astounding is that it will be a close election.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a testimonial to the power of money in an election.
Yeah.
Period.
And I mean, the fact that they'll actually... there's so many one-issue voters out there that it will actually be a close election is amazing.
Yeah, it truly is. And this is why Citizens United was not only the wrong decision, but it was the wrong direction. We need to be strengthening things like the McCain-Feingold law and the Tillman Act rather than blowing a hole in the side of them. Ron, thank you very much for the call. Well said. It's Rob in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think what we see here is... the end of an age of overactive paternalism, just like you had a guest yesterday talking about that.
Yeah.
And we're coming to the end of a cycle of thousands of years, what's known as known history. There were civilizations before that. I've seen the evidence before. This goes in cycles. What we're going to see here is the peeling away of the women from Republicans.
Yes. It's already begun.
I'm so glad that Rush Limbaugh and all the Republicans did what they did to reveal who they are.
Yeah.
They're setting this all in motion.
Yeah.
By the end of the year, I predict there will be no Republican Party. It'll be fragmented.
I think you're right. I don't think you're right on that. I think, that it's already, the Republican Party is already fragmented. It's being torn apart internally by the Tea Party.
It's going to get weirder than it is now.
Exactly. Very well said. Thanks a lot for the call. And just the idea of the Republican Party getting weirder than it is, it's pretty amazing. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You're the Peyton Manning of the news program.
Well, thank you. What's up?
Gotcha. Two things real quick. Could you talk a little bit more sometime about the plight of Pontiac, Michigan? I know you're a Michigander, and, you know, they sold off the Silver Dome and for pennies on the dollar, and a lot of other things are going on there.
Yeah.
But the thing I did want to ask about was, would you ever be able to find the tape of Ted Kennedy when he was on the House or the Senate floor, giving his speech on when does the greed stop, and it dealt with the minimum wage.
Oh, that's great. I will.
It's a really
yeah,
riveting.
Jacob says I'm on it. I'm sure it's living on YouTube someplace, and if so,
it is. I found it on there.
Yeah. Okay. We will track it down, and perhaps today, maybe tomorrow, we'll play a clip for you. Steve, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. When does the greed stop? We're out of time. 10 seconds. Okay. Not enough time to take another call, but Ted Kennedy asking that question, when does the greed stop? It really is the question. Paul Ryan requires his staff members to read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. Ayn Rand's role model was a man named Wayne Edward Hickman, who murdered a 12-year-old girl and then ransomed her body back to her father, who thought she was still alive. Hickman kicked the dead body out of his car as he drove off. This was the hero for Ayn Rand because he defied society's conventions.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We genuinely have, in libertarianism and objectivism and the Republican Party, we genuinely have a psychopathic economic worldview.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Okay, just a small matter of contrasts. We started the show out with a debate on the minimum wage. Well, not the whole show, second hour out, but you get the point. And Paul Ryan, of course, has come forward with his budget plan, which is just going to gut the middle class and elderly people and students. Anybody who wants to go to college, forget it if Paul Ryan gets his way. And it's going to give a $3 trillion tax cut to millionaires and billionaires. So into this milieu, let me share with you two contrasting perspectives. The first said so well by conservative Republican Ricky Santorum.
We need a candidate who's going to be a fighter for freedom, who's going to get up and make that the central theme in this race, because it is the central theme in this race. I don't care what the unemployment rate's going to be. It doesn't matter to me. My campaign doesn't hinge on unemployment rates and growth rates.
Right. We don't care about those poor people or those unemployed people or those middle-class people that are getting thrown out. No, we don't care about them, just so long as we've got our anti-gay agenda. That's Rick Santorum. Here is Ted Kennedy.
$240 billion in tax breaks for corporations, $36 billion in tax breaks for small businesses, increase in productivity, 42% over the last 10 years. But do you think there's any increase in the minimum wage? No. What is the price? We ask the other side. What is the price that you want from these working men and women? What cost? How much more do we have to give to the private sector and to business? How many billion dollars more are you asking? Are you requiring? When does the greed stop?
Well, brilliant. Teddy Kennedy, we miss you. We really miss you. And in answer to your rhetorical question, when does the greed stop? According to Paul Ryan, never. And what do you want? What do these people want from us? Everything. They want it all. Derek in Melbourne, Florida. Hey, Derek, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better, Derek. Hope the same is true to you.
I was listening to your discussion with the gentleman that said that the minimum wage increase they'd have to pass the cost on somewhere. Mm-hmm. But the real point to everything is that the minimum wage increases with the consumer price index. So if the minimum wage doesn't increase year over year.
It doesn't. It should, but it doesn't. Minimum wage is increased by an act of Congress, and it's been 10 or 15 years. It's been a long time since it was increased. I think it was the Clinton administration last time it was increased. And
federal minimum wage. I'm here
yes.
in Florida. I was speaking to Florida minimum wage.
Oh, your state so minimum wage is attached to the CPI? Really?
Here in Florida, it is.
Wow. What's the minimum wage right now?
I think it's $7.37, and we just had a 17-cent increase this year, something like that.
Well, if the federal minimum wage is $7.25, that's not all that great. I mean, that's...
It just caught up the floor. Anyway, so if minimum wage doesn't increase year over year, the cost of consumer goods does increase every year. So if it doesn't keep up with the CPI, businesses are actually paying their employees less and less every year.
That's correct. If you were to take the 1960 minimum wage and adjust it for inflation, it would be $8.46 right now. And it's not. It's $7.25. So what that means is that since 1960, minimum wage workers have lost about a buck and a half in terms of purchasing power with their minimum wage salary. So excellent point, Derek. Thank you for the call, and thanks for making it. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, Aaron. Hey, Aaron. What's up?
Well, hey there, Tom. First chance getting through to you with your new time, and now there's not much time. But I'd like to argue against you from the left in the way that you let your continuous parade of right-wing freaks come on and argue against you, and you give them a lot of leeway, latitude, time. Now, the caller earlier talked about some politicians. Why are they afraid to, you know, question this or criticize that, whatever he was saying, and tell the truth? And you said, well, it's because the big money essentially will kill them through the media, and therefore they'd be career suicide and nothing they can do. And I say that's just so funny, because in 08, we had, or Democrats had, all three branches of government.
Not true. Not true. I know that's a Republican talking point 101, Aaron, but it's not true. As long as there's a filibuster in the United States Senate, it's not true.
Tom, if you really want to get to the heart of this problem, my rebuttal comes within.
How many pieces of legislation did Nancy Pelosi pass out of the House of Representatives that were filibustered by Republicans in the Senate when the Democrats supposedly controlled the Senate? It's over 221.
Tom, if you want to get at the truth, you'll let me talk. If you want to win the argument and silence my viewpoint, you can keep doing what you normally do. I guarantee you, given the time, I would convince every one of your listeners that I'm right.
Aaron, when you throw Republican talking points out that aren't true, I have to call them out.
Tom, they are not Republican talking points.
Barack Obama never controlled the Senate.
Tom?
Not in any way that, you know, even when he had arguably a 60 vote majority, two of those people were independents. One of them was Joe Lieberman, who arguably is a Democrat. And then you had crazies like Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln and Democrats who were only marginally Democrats. The Democratic Party, it's not like it was during Franklin Roosevelt's time when he had an overwhelming majority and he could marginalize the conservative Democrats and actually pass New Deal legislation.
Tom, am I still on here?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm smarter than this, Tom. And you've given that speech. Everyone in your audience has heard you say that at least 1,000 times. We don't need to hear it again. I'm trying to say something different, and we would be making progress if you would have the guts and the open-mindedness to listen.
Okay, Aaron, give me a call tomorrow then, because we're out of time now. We'll try it again. I never shy, you know, from a debate. I think it's kind of funny that Aaron starts out criticizing me for debating people and then wants to debate me. But anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow. The Pacific Research Institute is going to drop by. Sally Pipes, talk about their plan for dismantling Obamacare. Oh, fun. And Ron Pollock of Families USA on what they're doing to save our health care. Good guy, Ron. And, of course, your calls in the news. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.